Thanks. So this is supposed to be a discussion. So I'll just start talking, and then as you have ideas, feel free to chime in, and we'll see how far we get. So if this were a seminar, this would be about work with Isaac Kim that will appear very soon, about using a medium or small-sized noisy quantum computer to help us do a calculation related to TensorNet, specifically to entanglement normalization, the multi-scale entanglement normalization ansatz, the MERA, that was invented by Guy-Fre Vidal. And so kind of the background here, what we're thinking about is, you know, we've sort of seen this explosion of growth in quantum technology. People are reporting qubits with better and better error rates. And if we can scale these things up, then we can build a large-scale fault-tolerant computer, as long as we can get below the threshold in these big systems. But there's still a lot of challenges to be met, and so it seems likely that in the near term, we'll be faced with a situation where we have a large but noisy quantum device that may be hard or impossible to simulate classically, and so you can ask whether you can do anything interesting with such a device. And we're certainly not the first people to ask this question. This is a question that many people are asking, but I think we have an interesting answer to that question. The answer is yes, we think, and it goes right. That's what I'll tell you about today. Okay. And kind of the idea we have is, basically we think that in the context of strongly interacting quantum many-body physics, you can do something interesting. And the picture that we have in mind is something like this. So a classical variational calculation would be, I have some classical processor here, and I can use this processor to measure or calculate the energy of some quantum system that I'm to approximate the energy. And then I have some over here, a classical optimizer. Which takes this information about the energy and feeds back into the processor and lowers the energy. So, you know, maybe this thing asks for the energy as a function of some parameters at nearby parameters, calculates a gradient, and then tells this thing to go in the direction opposite the gradient, for example.
And the energy is just something to be minimized, or is actually somehow energy of the system?
Yeah, let's say I have some system I want to I calculate the energy of that thing using this processor, and then I try to use this optimizer to minimize it. Right, so I'm trying to find the ground state, say, of some many-body system.
Calculating anything else, presumably it would be something else that you're...
Yeah, sure. I'm specifically calculating the energy here. I mean, I can compute other observables, that may be interesting, but specifically the energy. And so I guess the idea, which as far as I know, first kind of came from the quantum chemistry community, is to just replace this part with a quantum processor. So maybe we can ask a small or large-scale quantum device to calculate the energy for us, then feed those results into a classical optimizer, and then change the parameters of the quantum device so that the energy is lowered. So this is like some kind of quantum-assisted variational calculation, if you like. And so that's kind of what we have in mind for this approach. And the idea is essentially that, you know, we think that with, say, 50 qubits here, roughly speaking, you know, 50 or 100 something, with, say, some error rate of 10 to the minus 3, not fault tolerant, right? You know, that you could actually do something that you can't do in any classical device. Or it would be extremely hard. Okay. That is, you would require a lot more effort classically than you would quantum. Okay. So that's kind of the setting.
So 10 to the minus 3 is reasonably realistic? Or?
Yeah, we chose that number because that's what people have claimed in recent experiments. So that, in other words, it's meant to be sort of a realistic number, given where we are right now. And, you know, people are now claiming that they will have such devices in a year or a few years. So, of course, the bigger you get and the more error-free you get, the better this will work. So it's a it's a beneficial thing. So we need some requirements for this to make sense. First of all, we need that this small quantum device can physically represent in a valid quantum mechanical state of a larger system, right? Otherwise, you're sort of not doing a variational calculation. We also need that you can approximate with this scheme many states of physical interest. You know, if it only works for simple states, you may not be getting any advantage. And very crucially, we need that the resulting state preparation is resilient to noise, meaning noise somehow does not completely destroy the information you want to get out, for example, the energy. And then we'd like, you know, that there to be some decisive advantage over the corresponding classical calculation. So what we propose is a scheme that we call deep MARA, or deep multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or DMARA for short. And we claim that this scheme can address all the things that I just talked about and be significantly more powerful than just doing the same kind of variation calculation on a classical computer. Okay. So that's why I'm going to kind of try to explain to you this idea and how it works. And sort of the basic intuition is that we want to use all of our understanding of entanglements and complexity and ground states for some broad class of states to kind of reduce the many-body problem to some sort of essential local quantum problem. Maybe a problem that sort of scale by scale lets me analyze the system. And this local quantum problem is still hard to solve on a classical computer if it's a sufficiently complicated problem, but I'm still saving a lot of qubits and a lot of circuit by doing this reduction. So what are the key properties of this thing? So there's a variational parameter D. Capital D, which will be the depth of some circuit. And the idea is that we can, first of all, contract DMARA, meaning calculate physical observables, say local physical observables, in time D log N with order D to the D qubits. And here, capital N is the simulated system size. And D is the dimension of space.
So like number of particles or size of qubit, please?
Sorry, yeah, D is like the number of sites of some lattice. So if I want to do 1,000 sites, this is, you know, still a quite small number. Okay. And so this is really good because, first of all, the time to contract scales only logarithmically with the number of degrees of freedom and only proportional to this parameter D. And the number of qubits that you need to do the contraction doesn't scale with the system size at all. It's a constant number. Okay, so this is why it makes sense to think about doing this kind of calculation on a fixed size quantum device. Now, the corresponding calculation on the classical computer, at least if you do it naively, would take time and memory, which is exponential in little d and d to the d. So, for example, we did a rough, you know, just a very rough estimate. If you wanted to do this scheme in two spatial dimensions with a depth of, say, 3 or 4, we estimated you would need about 500 gigabytes of RAM, and the calculation would take several hours. But you could do the same calculation with 50 qubits in a few seconds if you were doing gates on a sort of microsecond timescale. So it looks like you can get a big advantage by using this kind of quantum device. The second important point I call this one. Point two, which is also very important, is that this representation, which I'll explain what it is in a little bit, can capture many states of physical interest. Many interesting states. Using only modest D. So there's no like theorem or anything here, but we in the paper we analyze many different kinds of systems and we give either proofs or strong evidence in different situations that this is a true state. Now, of course, I'll warn you, this is, of course, known not to be generally true. There are certainly ground states that don't have this property. But nevertheless, it seems to be a good approximation for many states of physical interest. And the kind of states I have in mind here are not just gap states, but, for example, quantum critical points, topological phases, they can all be represented with load depth in this framework. So the third important point is that the contraction of D-Mera is so-called noise resilient. And what that means is that suppose I'm doing this procedure on my quantum device and every gate has some error epsilon and every preparation and measurement procedure has some error epsilon. Then even though I'm applying a number of gates which scales with the system size, so the gate error is epsilon, then the error in local observables is order d to the big D to the little d plus 1 times epsilon. In particular, it does not depend on system size. So that's crucial. That means we can do a big size and there's no blow up. And this property is true, this noise resilience is true, provided the physical system satisfies a certain property, which in the case of a quantum critical point is the property that there is only one scaling operator with dimension zero, that's the identity operator, and every other operator has positive scaling dimension. That property is sufficient to give you this noise resilience. Basically, it means there's some map somewhere that's contracting, and so it sort of asymptotes to a fixed point, and the fixed point is stable. And finally, we haven't really shown this, we're still working on getting all the details right, but we believe it can be made variational in the sense that the calculation you do can be understood as a consistent set of data that would arise from some global quantum state on this sort of large system. That's a non-trivial claim, and we think it's true, but I'll refer you to the paper when it appears. Okay, so this is what we have in mind. So I'm next going to tell you what D-Mera is.
So local observable means really local at a site.
That's right.
So, you know, what if I want to worry about phase transitions, which means symmetry breaking on the scale of the whole system?
Yeah, well.
Am I deep water or does this still work?
It's not impossible. I mean, you can certainly detect critical points, even from local data, because you can actually extract correlation, you can actually extract critical exponents.
Yeah.
Because it's really, you really have a piece of the RG flow, so you can follow the way operators move. Now, it is actually a very good and important question what kind of states you can detect with this local information. For example, it's not clear you could detect a topological state in this way.
That's right.
But you might be able to at least see a local order parameter forming, for example, or to see some critical behavior. Okay, so let's imagine I have so my size n is, which I sometimes call L, which is the length, is 2 to the little n. So I have some number of qubits, which is 2 to a power. Just because I'm going to do some kind of renormalization group structure, and so it makes sense to have this. Then the idea is that I can think of a sequence of states labeled by index I, such that psi n equals, this is my target state, so I have a sequence of states, the final one is equal to the state I want, and they're related to each other recursively by a low-depth quantum circuit. So psi I plus 1 is equal to some depth D circuit times psi I tensored with a bunch of states, a bunch of extra qubits, which are initially in the zero state. So in other words, the physical pictures, I start with one qubit, I add another one, and I do some local operation. Then I add two more qubits in between them, then I do some other local operation. Then I add four qubits to make eight, and I do some local operation. And then I continue to do this over and over and over again until I reach the full system size.
So the UI acts on the 0, 0, 0 state as well, or only on...
That's right, yeah. It's sort of mixing in these unentangled degrees of freedom. So here's the picture. So let's say I have, coming in down here, so down here is psi I at the bottom. Here is 0, 0, 0, 0. So this is all psi I here. And then I apply on these lines, I apply some circuit, right? So let's say I do this, then I do the opposite pairs, like that. So this would have a depth of 1, 2, 3, 4, so this is a D equals 4 D pair. Okay, so this is the rule. You start with your state at some given scale, you tensor in the same number of degrees of freedom initialized in the zero state, then you apply a certain finite depth quantum circuit, and the output up here is psi I plus 1. Okay, so this kind of intuitively captures the idea of a normalization where you're expanding the system by a factor of 2 at every step. Okay, so any questions about that picture?
So,
yeah.
Why would it turn out? I mean, if you have deeper, you said you wanted to optimize the asymmetry, right? So, get it
from the lowest energy. Yeah, let's say I would fix D, and I would optimize over all possible choices of 2-qubit gates here to get the lowest possible energy.
But why would it ever be harmful to not just have larger D? I mean, why would D be optimal at some finite number?
Oh, no. So D is not optimal at a finite number. I mean, as I make D bigger, I get a better approximation. But the problem is my error scales with D. So the bigger I make D in this noisy situation, the harder it is to extract physical information. So there's going to be a trade-off for any given error and size that I can do. You'll also see that as I make D bigger, I need more qubits to do the calculation on the quantum computer. So it costs me more resources. So bigger D is better, for sure, variationally, but it costs.
But you're not inserting in more qubits before the...
Well, maybe I've shown you a piece of it here, and then down here or up there, I repeat the same procedure.
Right.
So the whole state involves lots of qubits. The crucial claim is that you can calculate physical properties using a subset of all these degrees of freedom that doesn't grow a system size. So this ansatz is called, it's called deep mara in analogy with Vidal's mara, where they're very similar in spirit. The main difference is the way that we group the degrees of freedom and think about the variational parameters. So in mara, we think of say taking many qubits and grouping them into one cluster. So we sort of group the qubits together into supersites, and then on these supersites, which consist of many qubits, we would apply some single layer, say, of, in the old terminology, these were sometimes called disentanglers, and then we would apply some isometry, say, and here the parameter which made it better was the bond dimension. So the more of these you grouped together, you could act as some bigger unitary on a bigger, like sort of two pair of neighboring clusters. And you didn't change the depth, you just changed how many you acted on, and you could variationally optimize your unitaries here. So now we're saying, don't group them like this. Just keep them all separate, but apply a certain depth. That's the difference. Now, because these are all finite, you know, unitaries acting on some finite set of degrees of freedom, every mara can be approximated by a d-mara. That's clear, because I could just act with two local gates and make these components here. But this organization of d-mara is more suitable to use on a quantum device, because it's already built out of the elementary things that you have access to directly as an experimentalist. But it captures very much the same physics. However, the crucial question for us from the point of view of, say, mara is how complex are each of those tensors? How many little gates does it take to make one of those big gates? If it doesn't take many little gates, meaning the depth is not too large, then you're in business. If it takes a lot, then you're going to have trouble. Okay?
And to compare the error,
This will have some similar properties, but the main question you have to ask in this setup is how many gates you have to apply to produce each of these unitaries. So the error will scale with the number of gates. So it's not manifest in this framework how the error works. And in the worst case, it could scale exponentially with the bond dimension, because these can be exponentially complex objects. And if you just did a mirror calculation, you on your classical computer, you optimize it, it's not clear that you're getting out some simple unitary or some very complicated unitary. So it's not clear. So when we address the question of whether d-mirror is a good approximation, we'll explicitly care about exactly how the depth scales with the degree of approximation. And we'll show that you can get away with a small depth. So let me talk about operator expectation value. And in d-mara, and here the story is very similar to the story in mara, which is looks like this. If I want to calculate the expectation value of some operator O at the ith plus one level, then I can find a unital quantum channel. So that means some quantum operation that preserves identity, such that the expectation value of operator O at level I plus one is equal to the expectation value of this operation, phi I acting on O, at one less level. Okay, and so let me, instead of saying a bunch of words, let me just sort of write out what this is. So how you should think of phi I acting on some x is that what I do is I apply ui dagger ui to x. So I'm kind of reversing this procedure here. And then I do a partial expectation value in this zero state, like that. So in other words, I have my operator up here, say. This is my operator O. I apply it to the system. I conjugate it with this circuit, which spreads the operator out somewhat. But then I project it onto zero state here, right? Because these are all some fixed initial thing. So I take my operator, I spread it, but then I project back onto you know, the degrees of freedom that are going down to the next level. Yeah.
Doesn't the state anyway only have support on this thing? So if you take the VFC psi I plus one that you constructed in that way and you reverse it, then you get for sure the zeros. So you don't even have to project.
Well, you know, if I take an operator up here.
Oh, it's the operator.
It's the operator. Sorry, yes. Yeah, it's the operator. Okay. Then the image can have it's supported in more than just zero tensor the span of psi I.
I confused it.
Yeah. Okay, and the crucial property of this map is that it doesn't make the operator grow too large. Because although you're expanding the operator every time, so like you have an operator here, say it's on one site, well, you apply this circuit to it. Well, in principle, the operator could spread quite a lot. It could be supported in this whole region down here. But then I'm projecting onto these zeros, and so that halves the size of it. And so if operator, if O has support support L, so it's supported on L sites, then phi I of O has support on L plus 2D over 2 sites, right? Because it can expand, each edge can go by D in either direction, but it have the number of sites. And so you see asymptotically, no matter how big it starts out, it's always going to be supported if you apply a few iterations on something of order roughly 2D sites.
This local structure that you're indicating in this drawing, that's really supposed to be. The circuit has this local structure in the sense that you're only acting on neighboring.
That's right.
Things.
So yes. That's the definition of the ansatz.
Yes. Okay.
And so it's costly for me to make it more non-local, and so I want it to be as local as possible. And so then you can kind of see, because the size of the operator is bounded, because it never gets too large, if I want to compute expectation values, I never need more than order big D to the little d number of sites. Because it's sort of the operator width is of order d, and so in little d dimensions, it can only be supported on, this many qubits, and so I never need more than that. It never gets really large. Right, so that's the crucial aspect of this local circuit. So, you know, to be precise, I could iterate this map over and over and over again and write the expectation value at the large system size as a sequence of these channels, of these operations, applied sequentially to the operator and then taking the expectation value in sort of zeros at the bottom. And the crucial thing is that this calculation can be done. This is like Mara, and so this calculation can be done on a classical computer without scaling with system size. That's really nice. The memory does not scale with system size, but it scales exponentially with big D. Because you need to store the state of, you know, say order D qubits, so that takes 2 to the D, you know, entries in memory. And so you're multiplying these matrices together that are essentially exponentially large in big D on a classical computer. But on the quantum computer, you just apply the gates. You just do the physical operation itself and compute the expectation value. So if the Hamiltonian itself, for example, is a local operator that consists of local terms, say on-site and nearest neighbor terms, or third neighbor or whatever, then the Hamiltonian or the energy density is such an operator that I could measure on my quantum device with resources that scale only with big D and not with total system size, and time that scales only logarithmically with the system size. So then the idea is to go back to my picture. You have a quantum processor. You measure the energy. You feed it into a classical optimizer. Then you lower the energy by adjusting the parameters of your quantum processor, right? So in other words, I would change the two qubit gates, sort of one at a time, say, to lower the energy that I measured via this procedure to try to find a representation of either the ground state or some, in practice, some low energy state.
So does it make it less likely that you would get stuck in some local minimum?
No, I mean, in fact, you could definitely worry that you get stuck in local minimum, and this does happen. So there are many complications with this optimization. So let me say, if you think about doing it gate by gate, then you can convince yourself that the energy as a function of a single gate, G, is trace G dagger rho G times H. So there's some density matrix-like object, some Hermitian-like object, which is like the energy, and this gate, and so it's a quadratic like that. And this is a finite dimensional. This is just a 2x2, you know, a 2-qubit unitary. So it's a 4x4 matrix. But I only get this number in a noisy fashion. I only get noisy measurements because my device is noisy. So what I need is a way to optimize this function with only access to the inductive function and with only noisy measurements of that function. Okay, so that's just a problem. You know, there's not, you know, some unique solution. You can certainly get stuck in local minima. We propose to use something called simultaneous perturbation stochastic approximation, which is just some thing, just an algorithm, which has the property, this is due to Spall from 92. This is an algorithm which essentially estimates the gradient in a noisy fashion, and like you sort of estimate the gradient in a random direction, then just go against it. And you sort of do this in a way that the step size decreases as you increase the number of iterations, so that you kind of converge at some point. So I'm happy to describe the details of this offline, but I don't think it's super illuminating here. The key point is just that this algorithm in practice seems to work well even with noisy data, so that it seems like a good fit for here. And we did simulation of this, numerical simulation of this procedure, and we find that in many cases you get low energy, you sometimes get stuck. The average looks pretty good. And in any event, you're probably going to sweep through the tensors of this network anyways. So even if you get stuck in a local minimum at one step, you can hope that by sweeping over and over again, you will eventually converge. There's no guarantee that will happen. This is quite analogous to what people do in ordinary mirror calculation on classical computer. So there's no guarantee it'll work, but it seems like a reasonable thing to try.
Yeah? Just to make sure you understand, so the fact that you could get stuck has nothing to do with this quantum process. This is just the general
correct. If, yeah, we're just...
You don't get any additional problems that you don't have before, apart maybe from the noise.
I'm not aware of any additional problem apart from the noise that arises in this procedure that you wouldn't have in an ordinary mirror.
Actually, what's the difference between this and ordinary mirror?
So, the The difference between this algorithm, or what's the question?
Mostly, like, what does this E stand for in front of
me? Oh, sorry, I guess I erased it. So,
is it the
loop? It's the depth of the circuit. So in ordinary mirror, I have, like, I just group everything into these big super unitaries that act on many degrees of freedom at a time. So I imagine decomposing those into 2-qubit gates. And the D is how many layers of 2-qubit gates I'm allowed to apply. So in other words, I have a picture like this, where I apply, you know, some particular depth. And the variational parameter, it's all 2-qubit gates, I never group anything together, I just sort of go for a certain depth, and my variational parameters are these different gates. Okay. So Mara is, this can represent a Mara by just approximating each of these things with 2-qubit gates, but its structure is somewhat nicer for the purposes of this sort of quantum device, because the depth is a crucial element, so it makes sense to sort of bring that out to the front, make it explicit in the definition.
But never scaled with the system size.
Well, in a calculation on a quantum computer, it would not scale. Now, if you ask me a theoretical question about how much the depth needs to be for high overlap with the ground state or for local probabilities to have certain fidelity, then that's a question which I can answer in some cases, and sometimes it does scale with system size. So, for example, in some cases, we can show that if the depth scales logarithmically with the system size, then you can get high overlap in thermodynamics. But we believe that, I'll tell you this in a second, actually, so just wait. So this is the idea for how you would use this as, say, a variation calculation. So now I want to talk about whether whether DMR is a good ansatz. What kind of quantum ground states can be represented efficiently with this circuit? So the intuition is that it has all the same properties as an ordinary Mara. So in particular, it can encode power law correlations and quantum critical scaling of entropy. So it seems like it at least has a possibility of representing, say, even quantum critical points efficiently. So the conclusion, actually, at least in some cases, that we can show that, yes, that's true. You can actually represent a critical point using this network with a modest depth. So first, let me talk about one-dimensional systems. And I'll talk first about non-interacting fermions. This is based on recent work with Yutho Hagemann, Michael Walter, Glenn Evenbly, Jordan Kotler, Volker Schultz, and myself. And what we do in this paper is to study a one-dimensional chain of fermions at half filling, so just nearest neighbor tight binding model, where there's one fermion per every two sites, so it's half filling. And it's known that the ground state of this nearest neighbor Hopping model at low energies is equivalent, or at least flows in some appropriate sense, to a quantum field theory, which is described by a single non-interacting Dirac fermion. And so what we did in this paper was to show that you can construct a circuit, an RG circuit, which actually has the explicit form of a D-mara. The reason being that in this non-interacting fermion context, all of the gates you need to apply are two fermion gates. So everything is already in this sort of two-body picture. And we show, building on work of Evenbly and White, that you can use some theory of some tools from the wavelet literature to actually construct this kind of circuit, this RG circuit. And we find, we prove a little theorem relating properties of the wavelet to the goodness of the approximation of the circuit. And then by numerically analyzing the wavelet, we found that the, if I say I want local data to precision delta, then I would need a depth. Sorry, I could achieve this with a depth d, which scales like log of 1 over delta. So relatively modest depth here, only scaling logarithmically with the desired precision. So if I want the energy density accurate to delta, then I only need this d, which scales logarithmically with that precision.
At this point, it assumes no errors.
Yeah, this is everything's perfect and unitary. I'm simply asking if I want to get local information precisely. Yeah. So this is a quantum critical point. It's a scale invariant state of matter. It has parallel correlations. It has logarithmic entanglement in the ground state. And nevertheless, you can represent it with this D-Mara framework with, I would say, essentially the optimal possible scaling of the depth with the degree of local precision.
So actually, so for arbitrary capital T, actually, you would always get an infinite correlation length, or there's a relation between correlation length and delta.
Even for finite D, you can still get long-range correlations, but say they won't be exactly translation invariant, and they won't have exactly the right exponent.
Okay.
So they'll look sort of different from what you would expect in the exact ground state. But you can actually look at our paper. We'll show examples for like D equals 2, 4, 6, how close you get to the correlator. You actually do quite well, even for, say, D equals 6. But that's a non-interacting theory. And you might object that's especially well suited to being described as sort of D-Mara framework, because it's all just two-body physics anyways. So what I also want to tell you is that we could ask the same thing about, this theory at low energies is a quantum field theory, and it has conformal symmetry, so it's called conformal field theory. We could also ask about strongly interacting.
Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah.
If you take a continuous limit, do you get the C-Mara in your
distance? If you take a continuous limit, well, I don't really know how to do that. But I guess, in some sense, C-Mara is already like this. If I assume it's composed of like local fields, if I don't allow like very non-local things.
It doesn't change. I mean, dimension doesn't change.
Yeah, yeah.
This is more closer to your construction.
Yeah. And also in C-Mara, the explicit unitaries are like made of local terms if they trotterize it. So it is kind of this class. You know, the worry you could have in general is that for Mara, say, the circuit needs to be some very non-local thing. You have to run for a long time to approximate. But here, it's not the case. Okay, we can't generally say much about strongly interacting CFDs, but we could appeal to the ADS CFT correspondence to ask if this gives us any tools to help estimate how the complexity of such a state of a strongly interacting CFT, how does it look like? And so, kind of remarkably, so there's two important facts here. The first of all is that I proposed some years ago that you could understand aspects of ADS CFT. Aspects of by thinking of the ground state, say of some lattice regulated version of the conformal field theory, as being constructed from one of these Mara-like circuits. Thinking of the regulated ground state. As being built from Mara-like circuit. And this is a picture you may have seen. You know, Tadashi drew this picture yesterday. The basic idea is that the metric of ADS has a form like this. There's a radial direction, and then there's the ordinary Minkowski direction, say in one direction, and it's like a hyperbolic-like geometry where you have space of the theory and then its radial coordinate. And the idea is, if you look at this metric, you'll see that the sort of effective size, the proper size of this, is decreasing exponentially every time you double this R. I should think of the R as like the number of steps in my renormalization group procedure, and this shrinking of the size here is sort of the same thing as projecting onto these zeros and thinning out the degrees of freedom. So in other words, you can basically just think of putting some kind of RG network, some like tree-like connected network here, and that was really a picture of ADS-CFT. The second important thing is actually there's now a conjecture going back to Linus Susskind for how to, and then sort of, I would say, improved upon or refined more recently by many people here, including work that I did with colleagues at Stanford, and also work by people at Perimeter, and actually elsewhere, in which there is now a holographic prescription for how to calculate the complexity of the CFT state. And what we mean by complexity is, roughly speaking, how many tensors there are in the tensor network that describes this thing. So in other words, basically the depth. Because I can compute, once I know the depth, just by counting the number of gates at every layer, exactly how many, the total number of gates in the system.
So in this picture, the depth takes up some of the
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, so the idea is, you know, every step of Mara is like going from R to 2R. And so inside that R to 2R, I put some gates. That's kind of the picture. And I don't want to tell you too much about this because, you know, this is a mixed audience and I'm sure it's not going to really sink in. But the main claim I want to make is that there's a quantity called the central charge that free fermion theory over there has central charge equal to 1. Central charge is denoted little c. And the claim is that the complexity, the total complexity of CFT is approximately given by the volume of space. This is the volume of the CFT space times c. So in other words, if I just took c copies of that free fermion theory, the complexity would be c times the complexity of each copy, right? Because I just tensor product all of the circuits together and I get the same thing. But what this is saying is that even in a strongly interacting theory, at this level of sort of vagueness, the complexity is scaling actually the same way, with the volume of space and the number of degrees of freedom.
So this
formula does not contain a D?
But wouldn't you expect the complexity to be larger if you have larger depth?
Yeah, so what I want to say is this is the holographic result. So I want to take this formula and then figure out what D has to be so that I recover this. And what you find is that, well, naively what this tells you is that D should be approximately a constant. Now, that's a little subtle because of the way holography works, where all the different pieces need to interact with each other. So what we can say is that a reasonable conjecture is that D should scale like C times log of the local precision. This is a conjecture. And the reason why this C is here is because you need every, if you sort of think of this system as like little clusters of C qubits on every site linked together, every layer of the network needs to couple every qubit within a site to every other qubit. And that takes C gates. The trade-off is that you, if you look in detail at the model, you realize that the typical gate complexity is small in the sense that it's close to the identity. So you have a lot of gates. You have sort of order C squared number of gates, but most of the gates are simple gates. They're very close to the identity. And so the overall complexity, if you count that smallness, is still proportional to C.
So that delta is like some infrared cutoff?
No, it's like how accurately I want the energy density.
Yeah, but actually, so not how finite D, which means that you are going just finite depth into the...
No, the number of RG layers is always infinite, or can be, it's related to the system size. This is like how much I do at each layer.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. I see. Yeah.
So as I do more and more at each layer, I can get a better and better approximation to the energy. And if this was too vague for you, you can actually, this is something we're working on now, you can try to make this a little bit more concrete by thinking about some very, very concrete holographic model. For example, something called the D1, D5 system in 1 plus 1. That system is very interesting because in a certain limit of that theory has a bunch of parameters, you can vary them. In a certain limit, that theory is actually just the theory of a bunch of copies of this free fermion plus a bunch of scalar fields symmetrized in some funny way. So we can actually estimate, given that result, what the complexity of that sort of symmetrized theory is, and it looks like it's consistent with a holographic prediction. Now, of course, that theory is very far from being gravity-like, but if you sort of imagine that the complexity is not going to vary discontinuously as you move around in this moduli space, then it seems reasonable to suppose that this is also a good caricature of the complexity of that interacting theory. But that's speculation, so I emphasize this is a conjecture which is sort of motivated by this holographic story, but not proven.
So your question, so this complexity formula applies only for CFTs that have an EDS dual, or is it, could I use it for rational CFTs? It's supposed to be valid?
Yeah, well, this is a rational CFT, right?
This one, okay.
This one is, and it has the same, the total complexity is proportional to the volume. So the conjecture would actually be, yeah, like basically any CFT has complexity that's proportional to central charge, the volume of space in some regulated setting, times, say, the log of the precision. That, you know, that's a bold claim, but it might be true.
Brian,
yeah.
Something related to the talk from yesterday. When you say the log of the precision, if I have a CFT, which is, where the space of fields is non-compact, then what is meant by the precision, or how exactly do you get a finite number out of this complexity? Because my impression is the cases you're talking about here are all cases where the field space, the target space, is effectively compact. So I know what it means to...
Whereas
the divergences in Shira's talk yesterday were really from the edges of field space.
So that's a great question, and in fact, that may lead to extra factors of
regulators or something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like we can always take a harmonic oscillator at some temperature T. You can show that you can compress that to order log T qubits.
Okay.
You know, with sort of high precision, you know, like. If you know, like say you want the support of the thermal state is approximately supported on a two to the, like a t-dimensional space, then just because that's how big the oscillator is, right? And then you can make that rigorous in some sense. So we want to do something like that. And that may give some extra logs of the energy and what precisely we want to have this approximation. So there could be extra logs there.
Is it something you'd expect to show up in the holographic measure of the complexity in some way? Because, you know, if you look at N equals 4 super Yang mills, it has scalars with non-compact target spaces.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I don't see why not. And maybe this is what the logs that we always find in action are. It's like plagued with these logs.
The question is there some way of converting the UV cutoff into a cutoff on field space? I guess there is. fields are dimensionful.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can say, like, yeah, you can say, like, if I suppose I concentrated the energy of the whole system into, like, one oscillator to give a really, you know, dramatic overkill, that still would only scale, like, the log of the total energy.
Or if we're talking about four-dimensional field theories, we've got the scalar operators have positive dimensions, so a UV cutoff is actually a cutoff at large distances in field space anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let me just briefly mention two dimensions. So actually, in this fermion paper we did, the natural analog of the one-dimensional thing would be a two-dimensional Dirac point, say on the honeycomb lattice. That's not what we studied, actually. That's a little bit harder. We actually studied fermions hopping on the square lattice. So you have a Fermi surface, which is perfectly square. And there we showed that a generalization of Mera called branching Mera could capture the ground state. And so you could actually imagine a generalization of D Mera called branching D Mera, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, but that case is not that different from 1D, right? You have a perfect nesting from the surface.
Yeah, that's right. So certainly that was crucial in our analysis. My personal belief is that we can go beyond that, but we haven't done that yet. But I would just say it's a reasonable conjecture to suppose that such a Dirac point or even a Fermi circle, let's say a Dirac point, could again be dealt with a depth scaling like log of the precision. So that's a conjecture, but it seems a reasonable one. You know, it may be like log squared or some other power, but it doesn't seem like it's going to require like some enormous depth circuit to get the physics right. And in fact, you could actually do this, you know, you could just variation optimize in your computer for a reasonably low depth and just see what happens, and it wouldn't be too bad, I think. And in fact, the holographic story is the same. This holographic complexity story doesn't depend on dimension in any way, so you get a similar kind of conclusion. Maybe it scales like some central charge, some measure of the total number of degrees of freedom times precision. Again, these are conjectures. But one case where we can say something concrete.
So here, what does central charge mean again? You have two dimension and.
I don't know. I mean, we know that A and C can't be that different from each other. In 3+1, A and C can't be that different from each other. So in that context, it wouldn't matter too much. Now, maybe it's F, or maybe it's C, the coefficient of the stress tensor two-point function. You know, I don't know. It's something like that. You know, whether that subtlety is important is beyond our understanding at this point. So let's say it's roughly the stress tensor two-point function, or the coefficient of the thermal entropy. So the other thing I'll mention are the new thing you get, which is interesting in 2D, is topological states. And we can actually prove something rigorous about these using something called, I think we call the adiabatic expansion property. I guess the first thing to say is, the first thing to say actually is that for simple like discrete theories like the toric code, we know there's an exact D Mera with some finite D that exactly captures the ground state. That's because these are special exactly solvable models. We furthermore know that there's a whole phase where this is a stable ground state. And within that phase, everything's related by some finite depth circuit. So that again looks like you're not going to lose a lot of depth even if you're at some random point. So if you're, say, in a spin liquid, which is a Z2 spin liquid, you can be confident that you're going to have this depth which scales reasonably with the local precision. But what about something like a fraction quantum Hall state where you don't have this solvable model? Well, there we can appeal to what we call the adiabatic expansion property, which is something like this. Imagine I have, say, a lattice model of some quantum Hall state, and I have a Hamiltonian H, which is defined on some linear size L lattice. So it's a torus, an L by L torus. So this is a Hamiltonian on L, L by L lattice. Right. Then what we believe is true, and we can show in some cases, is that there exists a Hamiltonian which depends on some parameter eta, where eta, say, lives in 0, 1, such that H of 0 is, say, the Hamiltonian on psi is L over 2. H of 1 is Hamiltonian on psi is L. H of eta is local. And H of eta is gapped. So in other words, I can smoothly interpolate between the system size L over 2 and the system size L with a gapped Hamiltonian for a time of order 1. So for example, for a lattice model of a Chern insulator, non-interacting Chern insulator, John McGreevy and I explicitly constructed such a Hamiltonian and showed rigorously that it remains gapped as you go from L over 2 to L. And we believe, although we didn't show, that the same would be true of a fractional quantum Hall state. And so then I think the idea is obvious. You would take this Hamiltonian and you adiabatically evolve with it to go from L over 2 to L. You'd trotterize that evolution, and that would produce for you some depth D circuit, but you know exactly how long you evolve for, how slowly you go, which would approximately map the ground state at L over 2 to the ground state at size L. And in fact, you know, because we know everything about adiabatic expansion, then we can actually estimate how much error you make and use that to bound the precision. So here we can conclude, actually in this paper John and I showed that this D was of order log 1 plus something, 1 over delta. So it wasn't quite log, but it was like any number bigger than 1 would be fine. This just had to do with some technical detail here. It's probably the case that it, even log would suffice. But so say like log 1.1 would be sufficient. Okay, and this is something you can show rigorously. So it seems to us like both chiral and non-chiral topological states in two dimensions can also be captured in this framework. And so actually the broad picture is that, you know, for any of an interesting class of gaps, topological or not states, and also quantum critical points between these states, this framework is a good one. So that's a very nice statement, if true. Because although we can't treat every kind of thing you might encounter, for example, Fermi surfaces are still outside of this, but any kind of sort of relativistic system looks like it's within this framework. All right. I'll stop soon. Let me just say, the last part is a bit technical, but so I won't go into it in too much detail. But the important points are, so this was, I first showed you what DMARA was. I showed you that it's faithful. The final thing you can ask is about this noise resilience. And here, physical idea is recall that expectation value of some operator O could be related to the application, the sequential application of many of these quantum channels. Right, I was just renormalizing. This was n minus 1. This is, say, 1. And that would give me the expectation value. So this final one just projects onto the zero state. Right, so it's an expectation value. So this sequence of unital channels would give me this value. And what we want to conclude is that even though the number of channels here scales like the log of the dimension, the log of the number of qubits, making an epsilon error in each of these channels only gives you an epsilon error here. And the reason why that occurs physically is because this map is kind of contractive in the sense that if all the scaling dimensions are positive, the non-identity map is getting suppressed every time. So it's as if you're operating with some dissipative system. And what that means is that even though you're making an error at every time step, because it's dissipative, because it converges to some fixed point, the fixed point can actually also be stable with the same error, even at late time. So that's a sort of the essential physics here. In this expanding universe picture, you have a similar kind of idea where what you're saying is, suppose I don't put actually exactly zero in at every step, and suppose the gates are not quite right, so I'm injecting some energy. But I'm also expanding the universe, so it's getting diluted. So I have some energy density at some given step. I dilute that because I make a system bigger, and then I add new energy in. But that dilution process has a fixed point, which is only finite energy density. So I don't heat the thing up to infinite temperature. I have only some finite sort of error, even if I go for arbitrary many steps of this expansion. And so this is sort of the essential physics behind the noise resilience, behind the fact that if these have error epsilon, then this has error that. And this factor occurs because we have that many gates in a single layer that touches the qubit, right? In D dimensions, we have sort of a D-dimensional cube, and we apply big D layer of that. Okay. And the other claim is, this is the noise resilience, the other claim is that it's a variational calculation. So it's legitimate to compare this to other variational procedures. That's a non-trivial claim. You need to verify that the state you produce is a valid state of the many-body system. We think that's true, but I'm not going to go through it here, because it's still dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. So I'll just conclude with talking a little bit about applications and extensions. So the kinds of things that you can try to do with this are various and multiple.
If your circuits don't have all the same errors, but the distribution, what's going to happen? Do you have some sort of device? Like quantum experience. And number 7 has 1%, and circuit number 2 has 10 to the minus 3. So.
Yeah, well, you would definitely take the upper of those things in general. I mean, at the level of a proof, that was what we would do. In practice, it may work better than that. But we don't
have this convergence.
Yeah, we have this convergence. Right. So, the real meaning of this is like that this superoperator is close to the other one in diamond norm, with epsilon, and so then you can prove something. So as long as that's true for everything, maybe you have some good ones, but as long as you take the worst case, then this is the theorem goes through. But it could be better than that. For example, in this holographic thing that I mentioned where all the gates are close to the identity, typically you have much better error for something like that, where you're doing something small and coherent instead of something big and coherent. So it may be that even though you need a lot more gates, you actually have more favorable scaling of the error with the depth than you would have naively. But this is just something you have to run it and see what happens. Yeah, so what could you do with it? You can certainly benchmark this on something you understand, like a 1D Ising model. There are also interesting one-dimensional theories of central charge bigger than 1 that you could try to attack. That would be very interesting. In 2 dimensions, Kagame anti-ferromagnet would be a very interesting thing to look at. That's been a subject of a lot of debate. What kind of, if there's a spin liquid there, what kind of spin liquid? You could even attempt the Hubbard model. There's nothing necessarily stopping you from doing that. Say the fermionic Hubbard model. You might worry about the depth there, but then you could have some generalized thing. And you could even do 3 dimensions that doesn't scale with dimensionality in any really terrible way, unlike the classical case. Doing a mirror in 3 dimensions is completely hopeless. But here, because it's really this cluster, it seems reasonable. And some of the things we're thinking about extending this to include this idea of branching D-mirror, which could handle Fermi surfaces potentially. We're also thinking about doing thermal physics. So here I sort of talked about preparing ground state or low energy state. Could you prepare some mixed state, say, and sort of minimize the free energy variationally using your quantum device? That would be very interesting. Then you could study thermodynamics. If you could do this for the D1, D5 system, you could measure black hole entropy on a quantum computer. That'd be very interesting. We're also interested in dynamics. And, you know, and ultimately, rather any of this idea can feed back on the classical simulation side and give us new ideas there. You know, so we hear this story about how, you know, the quantum approximate optimization algorithm beat some classical algorithm for a while, and then the computer scientists band it together and crushed it again with their classical method. So it would be great if someone did that here, because then it means we can do classical simulation for bigger, more complicated systems. So that's another interesting possibility. So I think I'll wrap up there. It's a bit early, but I don't really have anything more to say at this point. So. So discuss.
Two questions. If you, instead of having a D depth, you had a D local gates, which is one operator operation with D local gates, would that amount increase here, or would it decrease your gates?
No, well, it's really a question of what the experimenter can do. The experimenter cannot apply D local gates. So what they would do is you would have to tell them how to make it from two local gates, and they would make it. And the crucial question then is how complicated it is to make that thing. So I think you'd get back to the same idea.
So this phi is a superoperator that's constructed by a lot of gates, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's actually the challenging part there is to have a to approximate phi up to epsilon. I mean, you have to have a good approximation for each gate to have an epsilon approximation of this big superoperator, right?
Yeah.
And on the topmost level, this error should go like 1 over n.
Yeah, I mean, I guess actually this is a typo or a write-o. This should be d squared. Because the gates have epsilon in diamond norm. So this has the number of gates in it times epsilon.
No, but topmost level, it will scale with the system.
Yeah, but so. No, it won't. No, it's just the number of gates in each layer. That's crucial.
Which scales with the system size?
It does not scale the system size.
But there's local.
No, so, I misspoke again. That's a spico. It scales with the depth only, right? Not with the number of qubits at any layer. It scales with the depth.
But what's your error for each local gate?
Epsilon. So
which decays with the system size.
No, it does not. So in other words, I let's say I choose depth 4, and the local error is 10 to the minus 3. Then the error here, my upper bound, my theorem says that this is like, you know, 16 times 10 to the minus 3 in one dimension. Now, it may in practice be better than that. In fact, we did some numerics, and it looks pretty good. You know, like error of 10 to the minus 3 gives you error of 10 to the minus 2 or less sometimes, you know, for depth of 4 or 5. And in the fermion case, it's already sufficient to get something interesting. So, no. It's certainly not a trivial thing, but it's not hopeless either. It definitely does not scale with the system size. It scales with the depth.
It's the point that you don't accumulate across the circuit because those things never talk to each other.
That's right. Yeah, like in Mera, you know, they're unitary, so they cancel. Here, it's unital channel, so still it cancels away unless you have some operator there. So the crucial point is that local operators can be computed, their expectation values can be computed with a constant number of qubits, no matter how big the system is.
Yeah.
And the number of gates you have to apply is proportional only to the log of the system size. So you need only constant qubits and only log depth circuit to do that.
Yeah, okay. For the local expectation
values. For the local expectation values. I mean, actually, that's also true for two-point functions or three-point functions, but...
Say a little more about the noise model. I mean, how are you modeling the noise? Is it are you assuming that's independent on each gate or?
So we like in the numerical experiments we did, we assumed just depolarizing noise, you know, with probability 10 to the minus 3, acting independently on every gate.
But does your theorem depend on that though, or?
Yeah, I mean, if the noise is correlated between different gates. I think you would have something similar, but you would need, you know, the precise statement would certainly vary. And maybe it's more serious. The statement about the variational nature of it depends on this to some extent. Like if the noisy thing you're doing to two qubits depends on the neighboring qubits, that can be problematic for making it a valid quantum state at the end. But at this level, I think like any kind of short-range correlation wouldn't fundamentally alter the result. It might change the scaling more less favorably. But I need to think carefully about that before I made a definite statement.
How important is it that you alternate these zero qubits in between for psi? Could I just like randomly put in these zero qubits?
I mean, I guess you could. But what I would worry is that there are some regions where operators are getting very big because you're not projecting them down. So the interleaving the zeros is supposed to be this expanding space picture where I double the size of space at every step and I do that uniformly. So every point gets further apart from every other point by a fixed amount. So you could certainly consider something different. I'm not sure you would get any performance advantage from that. But you know, I don't know. I haven't thought carefully about it.
Thank you.
Thanks.